There were massive protests against the Russian invasion of Ukraine all across the world this weekend in Washington, Berlin, London, even Moscow. Today, delegations from the two countries met in Belarus for their first talk since fighting broke out last week, even as Russia intensified its attacks on Ukraine. Ukrainian officials say the country's second largest city, Kharkiv, came under heavy rocket fire today. And since the fighting began, Ukrainian officials say hundreds of civilians have been killed. Meanwhile, the United States and Europe implemented harsh sanctions, basically freezing hundreds of billions of dollars Russia had put in reserve. The ruble tumbled, Russians flocked to ATMs to withdraw their money, and the Moscow Stock Exchange didn't even open today. Here to talk about the latest is Burbank Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff. Congressman, welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, your colleague, Illinois Republican Adam Kinzinger, says the U.S. should enforce a no-fly zone over Ukraine to help Ukrainians on the ground who are really trying to save their country from this Russian aggression. Do you agree that we should consider a no-fly zone?
I think that would be a pretty bold step. I don't think I'm there yet, and I'm probably not going to get there. We don't want to get into a shooting war with Russia over Ukraine, and the president has made it clear we're not sending troops to Ukraine. And I think if we were to try to police the airspace there, you could see an American plane or a Russian plane get shot down with severe escalatory consequences. So much as I respect my fellow Adam, I don't think I'm ready to go there. But I do think that the work the administration has done to beef up sanctions has been remarkable, and the degree to which Europe and NATO have come together, I think, is beyond anyone's expectation and probably beyond Putin's expectation. And it's putting a lot of pressure on Russia right now.
Well, talk about that. How will it directly put pressure on Russia to perhaps reconsider this act of war?
Well, it's going to really, I think, cripple the Russian economy, and it's already causing capital flight. It's causing the value of what Russians hold to be worth a lot less. And so the Russian people are feeling the economic consequences of the folly of Vladimir Putin. There are protests breaking out in Russia, which are a remarkable show of courage by the Russian people. The oligarchs are feeling it. The oligarchs are having their travel circumscribed, their assets put in question. And so I think from the wealthiest to the poorest Russians, they're going to see the consequences of Putin's naked aggression against its neighbor.
But how will they not blame the West and blame the United States instead? And that might have a boomerang effect.
Well, you know, certainly Putin is trying to saturate, I think, the airwaves in Russia with propaganda. But, you know, frankly, I don't think the Russians are going to buy it. You know, a lot of Ukrainians have ties in Russia and vice versa. The claims that, you know, somehow the Ukrainian government is run by a bunch of neo-Nazis just isn't credible. And I think a lot of Russians are questioning why this move. And over time, as the conflict becomes more protracted and more Russians come home in body bags, I think the Russian people are going to have even more serious questions about why their leader has gotten them into this disastrous war.
You know, there's this viral phrase now of Zelensky saying, "I don't need a ride, I need arms." And when he was offered an airlift out of the country by the United States, how much should the United States supply Ukraine militarily?
We are supplying a lot, and the administration just approved hundreds of millions worth of military support in addition to what's already been provided. I strongly support these efforts, and I'll support more efforts to help equip the Ukrainians to defend themselves. I think part of the reason why you're seeing even Europe come to the conclusion they ought to supply weapons to Ukraine as well as invoke these unprecedented sanctions is, and frankly, inspiration at how the Ukrainians are pushing back and fighting back and fighting for their homeland and their democracy. I think it's inspiring the rest of the world to come to Ukraine's defense even more. So I'm glad that we are providing vigorous military support. I'm glad that Europe is going to assist with that. And I'm certainly ready to do more. And on a very bipartisan basis in Congress, I think that's the prevailing view.
How bipartisan is it? We have seen comments from the right, including from former President Trump, supporting Russia. I guess he walked that back a little bit over the weekend. But how united is Congress on this, do you think?
Well, I would say there's a strong degree of bipartisan support to come to Ukraine's aid. But you're right, there is a influential pro-Putin wing of the Republican Party, an authoritarian part of that party, that is so exemplified by Donald Trump and his praise of Putin. But there's a broad group of Republicans within the House and Senate who are ready to support stronger sanctions, who are ready to support more military assistance. And they represent at least where the Republican Party used to be, and I hope will be in the future.
What more could the United States do when it comes to sanctions?
There are, I think, additional ways that Russia can be cut off from SWIFT. The fact, though, that the United States was able to get Europe to go along with deploying a partial cutoff from SWIFT is hugely impressive. The degree to which, frankly, our NATO and European allies and other allies around the world are joining in this really brutal sanctions on Russia is remarkable. I don't think that any of us would have predicted quite this state of affairs before the conflict began. So there are additional oligarchs that can be added to the list. There are additional ways to squeeze Russian banks. There are additional ways, frankly, to go after Putin's wealth. And I'm sure that if the conflict continues, as tragically it's likely to, we'll be exploring these other remedies as well.
Well, speaking of Putin's wealth, it's been really hard to pin down exactly where it is, right? And he's been able to hide it quite cleverly. His wealth is estimated to be around about $100 billion. But most of these holdings are not known. So how do you crack down on Putin's wealth?
Well, we've got pretty good capabilities of following the money, including Putin's money, and we're going to deploy those. Our allies are going to deploy those. So, yes, he tries to hide his money. He uses his oligarchs to help him hide money. But we can track, if not all of it, we can certainly track a lot of it, enough to make him pay a personal price for engaging in this unprovoked war.
Let's talk about the nuclear threat. Yesterday, Putin said he had put his nation's forces, his nuclear forces, on special combat readiness. How concerned are you about that he could actually unleash a nuclear strike?
Well, I'm concerned that any time where the Russian dictator starts talking about his nuclear armament, I think this is his way of turning up the temperature. And look, it's working. It certainly has gotten our attention and the world's attention. So it's a concern that he would even talk about this or take any steps along these lines. It's one of the reasons why we're being very careful, and I think we're going to be very careful to avoid any provocation on our part. But whenever you have a nuclear-powered country and its leader talking recklessly about nuclear weapons, when it has just initiated a war of its neighbor, an invasion of its neighbor, it's cause for a lot of concern.
Yeah. Well, are you worried that these increased sanctions could be used by Putin as a pretext, as a, quote, act of war to do that?
I don't think that that's the path that he would go down. If we're going to see a response to the sanctions, I think we'll see potentially a cyber response by Putin. Certainly they're already using their cyber weapons against Ukraine. But I think that would be a more probable result if we see any retaliation on the Russian side.
And finally, some people, including former DNI James Clapper, are really publicly questioning Putin's mental state. Clapper told CNN he thinks Putin is unhinged. What do you think?
I think that Putin has been very isolated during the pandemic, and you can see in the footage when you see him how far away he is from everyone else. And I do think that isolation has an impact on everyone, and it certainly has had an impact on him. You know, whether we can conclude he's clinically got mental health issues, it's so hard for us to understand how he could invade a country in this century, in the heart of Europe, that we tend to think, okay, that person is just not sane. But it's calculated. And so I think that there's a real danger that he's gotten either bad advice or no advice from people around him, that he's increasingly isolated and prone to make bad judgments. And I think he's made a supremely bad one with this invasion.
Well, Congressman Adam Schiff, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
That's Burbank Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff. Coming up, how Donald Trump is able to skirt fundraising rules while drumming up support for a possible presidential run, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Over the weekend at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Orlando, former President Trump implied strongly he's going to run again in 2 years.
November 2024, they will find out like never before. We did it twice, and we'll do it again. We're going to be doing it again a third time.
Trump has not formally declared or filed any paperwork to run, but he is clearly the front runner in a straw poll. Nearly 60% of CPAC attendees said he is their favorite for the GOP nomination. The runner-up, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who trailed Trump by 30 points. Trump's status as unofficial GOP standard bearer is triggering the ire of at least one candidate who has already formally declared. It's Monday, so Press Play's legal Jessica Levinson is here. She's a professor at Loyola Law School, and among her many talents, she is an expert on election law. Hello.
Hello. I'd almost forgotten that, but yes.
Well, time to rev that engine back up again. All right, so there he is saying November 2024, we'll do it a third time. How is that not declaring? Do you have to say, I am now declaring to be president? Do you have to say those words?
Pretty blank and close to that, yes. So this is what I do remember, which is that the law does not always catch up with common sense. And so we hear things like Trump saying, November 2024, we'll do it again. And not just former President Trump. By the way, we hear other candidates say things like, we've got to go get them again, or let's get back into this fight, or, you know, I can do this for you. I can make big changes. And the answer is that we require a lot more, and frankly, something much closer to kind of the magic words of Donald Trump for 2024. And we require that you file paperwork. And so we basically allow plenty of, you know, people kind of playing at being a candidate before the legal machinery comes down on them and then they actually become candidates.
So what happens in terms of that legal machinery? Once you declare, how does that change things, especially for someone like Trump, who is quite adept at raising money for something without declaring?
Well, and that's exactly why he doesn't want to declare, and exactly why a lot of candidates don't, which is that that legal machinery is basically limits, limits on how much money you can raise, limits on who you can raise it from, limits on how much money you can spend on certain activities and reporting requirements. So it's limits and it's disclosure. And frankly, he doesn't want any of that. Now, there is this kind of middle ground that the Federal Election Commission allows, and it's called testing the waters. So it's kind of like dating, but not being engaged. And so you're supposed to be monogamous, but you don't have to say we're in this forever. And it says that you can kind of try it out and see if you're a viable candidate. But if you do certain things, and because it's a law, it's a multi-factor test and it's not always a bright line, but if you do certain things that make it look like, okay, you're not testing the waters anymore, clearly you are going to run, then you get kicked into that kind of more stringent area where you have to register with the FEC. And there's a lot more, and again, strict regulations on raising money, spending money, and reporting that money.
Is there a deadline to be a declared candidate?
Yes, but we can basically back that up from the deadline is really about getting on the ballot. So there's a deadline kind of forward looking in the sense of you can't play at being a candidate too long. At a certain point, people are going to say, look, I think you've been raising money and claiming that you're going to run for quite a long time. Now, one thing to remember is, of course, there's certain things that are written in our congressional statute when it comes to candidates. There's certain things that are written in an administrative code in the sense of the Federal Election Commission. But then let's remember, we have an FEC that's basically deadlocked and dysfunctional. So somebody can say to the FEC, former President Trump sure is running, and it's not at all clear that they would move forward on that. Now, we still have the option of somebody going to court, but that's a long way of saying, even if Trump gets too close to the law, it's going to take a while for anybody to be able to get any remedy as a result of that, if they even could.
Yeah. Well, someone already has gone to court, a man named John Anthony Castro, who is running for president, and he has filed a complaint in the D.C. Federal District Court saying that it's really unfair. He's suffering a competitive injury because Trump hasn't declared yet. Is there any chance he might prevail?
I don't think so. I looked at the filings, and you know, anytime somebody says really unfair or competitive injury, that's different from I'm looking at this part of the code, or I'm looking at this part of the statute, and this specifically is what he violated. Now, I know his filings are more detailed, but at this point, given how much discretion we really allow people before they jump that line to becoming candidates, given the current state of the FEC, given how much judges typically don't like entering the so-called political thicket, no, I don't think that this is a winner.
All right, let's turn to another story. A big case argued before the Supreme Court today. Several cases rolled into one, and West Virginia and some of its coal companies are suing the EPA, but they're suing over a now defunct rule, right? That was put in place by the Obama administration.
Exactly. And that's what I think is going to feel a little weird for some people, which is that this rule isn't even in effect. And the Biden administration has specifically said, because they're so worried about what the Supreme Court might do, you know what? Really, this law is not in effect, or this regulation is not in effect, excuse me. And we're not even going to try and rewrite it. And we're going to try and regulate this in a different way, which shows you how much this administration and even blue states are saying, basically, Supreme Court, we don't need you here. And here in this case is, you know, we begin in 2009, the Obama administration realizes that the US really needs to take the lead when it comes to climate change and specifically carbon emissions. And they put into place this plan of having the EPA set carbon limits for each state and, or excuse me, carbon limits. And then they tell states, please comply with this. And that's instead of just directly regulating coal-fired power plants. Now, the legal question is really whether or not the EPA can do this and whether or not Congress gave the EPA enough authority to do this.
And that is the big question of this case and why the court took it up potentially, is they want to define or change the way agencies issue regulations.
So, yes, I mean, obviously, this case has big implications for the EPA, for environmental protection, for climate change. But the reason that a lot of people are saying, I know this is a big term where we're all looking at abortion, we're all looking at gun control, we're all looking at a lot of, you know, blockbuster issues. The reason people are saying don't lose sight of this case is because it really does deal with whether or not this conservative majority of the court is going to try and pull back on the power of federal agencies to issue regulations that they say are within the public interest. And Madeline, this is something we've talked about before, this idea of, you know, the power of the administrative state and of some conservative jurists, some of them are on the court saying, we don't want to defer to federal agencies. That would really upend our system. And that's not just about the EPA. It's not just about the SEC. It's not just about the Federal Reserve Board. It's about all of these federal agencies.
Wow. So potential big, big change. Okay. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how Trayvon Martin's killing sparked a new civil rights movement.
It started with Trayvon. Trayvon was to this generation what Emmett Till was to the generation before us.
The Reverend Al Sharpton is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Saturday was the 10th anniversary of Trayvon Martin's death. He was killed in Florida after going to the store dressed in a hoodie to buy some Skittles. Trayvon was killed by George Zimmerman, a member of the Neighborhood Watch. His death, Zimmerman's trial, and the ultimate acquittal of murder there became the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement. On February 5th, Trayvon Martin would have turned 27. And his mom, Sabrina Fulton, celebrated her son's birthday with a walk for peace.
We do a peace walk to let the community know, let the nation know that he had a right to walk in peace without being followed, chased, pursued, profiled, or murdered.
Sabrina Fulton is one of many people featured in a new book written by the Reverend Al Sharpton. It's called Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. And among other things, it tells the stories of mothers who became unexpected activists after losing a child to racial violence. And joining me now is the Reverend Al Sharpton. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, take us back 10 years because you were there. Trayvon was killed in late February 2012, but in March, George Zimmerman had still not been arrested. So you went down to Florida, you held a rally. What had you hoped to accomplish then?
When Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon's mother, and Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, came to New York to see me with attorney Ben Crump, I had not really heard a lot about the case. When I met with them and they told me that this guy who was at best a neighborhood watch member, wasn't even clear if he was that, killed him because he suspected he was doing something wrong and that they would not even arrest and try Zimmerman based on a stand your ground law, I was outraged. And that's when I called for a rally there in Florida to demand his arrest. And we ended up with about 10,000 people at the first rally in Sanford, Florida, and began bringing national exposure. In a matter of weeks, they decided to bring in a prosecutor, and the prosecutor did, in fact, arrest and indict Zimmerman. So what I wanted to accomplish was to bring national attention and for our group, National Action Network, and other groups that weighed in to get him arrested and charged and get a trial.
Mm. So he was tried eventually and then found not guilty of all charges. And then that, I guess, provided the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement. There was a hashtag that emerged right after that, and the a movement was born. So I guess out of the ashes of defeat arose this phoenix?
I think that out of the ashes of defeat, movement continued. Certainly, George Zimmerman getting acquitted made these brilliant young ladies come up with the slogan. But again, every slogan needs a movement and needs those that will move in it. So whether it was young activists, whether it was the NAACP, all of us were part of that ongoing movement that went on from there to Eric Garner in New York and Michael Brown in Ferguson, all the way to George Floyd now. It started with Trayvon. Trayvon was to this generation what Emmett Till was to the generation before us. I was 1 year old when Emmett Till got killed, so I didn't know anything about it. But I remember talking with Rosa Parks, and she said when she refused to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama, all she could think of was Emmett Till. And I think that many people in the latter part of the first decade of the 21st century into the second decade would think of Trayvon Martin when they were faced with any form of discrimination, particularly when it was based on being profiled.
Yeah. Well, there are so many similarities. They were both teenagers. They were both out buying candy and then basically lynched. Talk about meeting his mother, because you write about that in the book. You met her three times, right? Mamie Till Mobley. And she, like you, understood the power of the media in calling attention to the unjust killing of her son.
Yeah, Mamie Till Mobley was such a regal and very religious woman. She told me that she was determined to make this nation have to deal with what they did to her son. And what she did was dramatically made them have an open coffin to show how bruised and battered his body was when they killed him. Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, were Black-owned magazines at that time, published a photo which caused a huge outcry around this country. But one of the things I learned is that you must dramatize an issue to get public attention. Because if you cannot get public attention, you will not get accountability. So that is why when Mamie Till Mobley opened up that casket and dramatized what happened, I know it was painful to her. She talked about it, for a mother to see a child like that. But had she not done that, I don't think the Emmett Till case would have ever been where it was.
Still, in that case, like Trayvon's, the perpetrators were found not guilty.
Right. And that's why the movement is not a sprint. It's a marathon. We've gone from Zimmerman acquitted 10 years ago to now where we see three policemen convicted for not interfering with the killing of George Floyd after they were convicted of Chauvin and sentenced to life in jail for putting his knee on his neck. I could see in a decade that we've changed enough of public opinion and culture that you can now get even in Brunswick, Georgia, which is not a major metropolis. It's rural Georgia. 11 whites on the jury, one black, convict their neighbors for killing Ahmaud Arbery. But now we still can't get the George Floyd bill through the Senate and the voting rights bill through the Senate. So we've got to have our demonstrations reap legislation, and the battle continues 10 years later.
Right. So what do you think caused this change in the courts? Was it the George Floyd protests?
I think a lot of the protests, I think a lot of the sensitivity, I think a lot of young people that were kids when Trayvon got killed, and they've effectively said to older people in other communities, this doesn't make sense. Because you have to remember, this happened in the middle of a pandemic. So everyone was home looking at the news, wondering, is it over? Can I go back out tomorrow? There was no distractions, no sporting events there. And they kept seeing over and over and over again what many of us have had to see for a long time. And it outraged people. I went to some rallies for George Floyd that there were more whites than black. So it broke out in a way that I think that showed us that many young Americans grew up with a much different view of the criminal justice system in these cases than we saw even a decade ago.
Well, let's talk about that, because now there seems to be a pendulum swinging back a bit. We just had this debate here in Los Angeles, the first televised debate for mayor. The primary will take place in June. Not a single candidate talked about defunding the police. In fact, all but one wanted to increase funding for the police. So given the fact that there is an increase in crime, murders in particular, what do you think about this movement to call police accountable? Is it facing some headwinds now?
Well, I think that as you saw in the civil rights movement of the 60s, there are different approaches to how we deal with things. Some call for defund the police. Others say, how do we reappoint where the funds go? And others are saying we need to have more strict training. Others are defending the police. So there's never been a monolith. You had Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael with Black Power, and Malcolm X all at the same time. So I don't think it's a headwind at all. I think that some people that have raised some things are finding people opposed. Others are finding that their approaches are gaining traction. And I think that we will see where it goes. Clearly, with the rise of crime, we need to have a balanced approach, but aggressive, where we hold police accountable, where police cannot do criminal acts unaccounted for. But at the same time, there must be community policing where we deal with gun violence and where we deal with criminality. Blacks and browns are disproportionately the victims of both police crimes and gun violence. And we cannot sacrifice one for the other. We must deal with both.
That's the difficulty, though, right? It's very hard to thread that needle to crack down on crime and then to, which inevitably leads to, well, a crackdown on Black and brown communities. It just,
well, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. When we fought to stop the stop and frisk practice in New York, crime went down in New York. So I do not believe that there is any proven data that to give people their rights is going to increase crime. I think that a lot of what we're seeing now is we've got to deal with gun manufacturers, gun distribution, and the aftermath of the pandemic. I don't see any data that says that you have to take people's civil liberties in order to control crime. I don't agree with that.
Although that is what happens usually. I'm not saying that that's what should happen, but that often is what happens, is if you have a crackdown by police, inevitably some people get profiled and
But why does it have to be a crackdown by police? Why can't it be community policing? Why does it have to be a crackdown?
Right.
That's why I used the example of what we did in New York. There was no crackdown and crime went down. It went down more than it had in decades.
But now it's back up. And so what would you like Eric Adams to do in your city?
I'd like Eric Adams to have a balanced approach of community policing, as well as holding police accountable. You do not solve civilian crime with police crime.
Did you ever support the movement to defund the police? And if so, where is that now?
I always said, first of all, there are different parts of even defund the police. I support those that say we need to reappropriate the money and put money in training, put money in mental health and all of that. There are some that say don't have police at all. I believe you've got to have some law enforcement, but I think that to reinstitute and to keep spending the money and the budgets the way that have already failed is a misnomer. Is that part of defund the police? I think that people have been able to distort the slogan to with the way they want.
Mm-hmm. Just before Christmas, a young woman was struck by a stray bullet while she was trying on quinceañera dresses at the Burlington factory in North Hollywood. The LAPD was firing at a guy who had been attacking customers with a bicycle lock, and a stray bullet killed her. And I just want to play a clip of tape of you, because you flew here and spoke at Valentina's funeral.
Whether you are from South Central, Harlem, or Chile, right is right, and right must stand up for those that are right.
Ya sea que tú seas del Sur Centro, de Harlem, o de Chile, lo correcto es lo correcto.
So what were you saying there? What do you want to happen in that case?
I think that this recklessness ought to be prosecuted. I was asked by the family to come out and do the eulogy at the funeral. I did. And I think that it goes around police accountability. The officer that did the shooting was Black. The victim was Chilean. And I wanted to come and say whether the officers are Black or white, they must be held accountable. This recklessness, how can you shoot so reckless? That, to me, warranted us to call on.
And so, when people call, do you normally come? I mean, you give so many speeches, you stand next to so many victims of racism and police brutality. How busy are you doing this kind of work?
Well, busy. I lead a national organization. We have an office there in Los Angeles. We have offices all over the country. And when people ask, we try to serve. you're right. We are in a lot of places, but I never go anywhere that we're not caught. Many of these cases we've never heard about till they come to us, including Trayvon. And they come to us because they know we will come, and that we will if we agree that there's been a situation that is egregious. We will try to make sure everybody knows about it. That's part of what civil rights is, to dramatize. You cannot correct something that is hidden. You must make it a public outpouring. Martin Luther King used to say, there are those that are two types of leaders. There are thermometers and thermostats. Thermometers judge the temperature in the room. Thermostats change the temperature in the room. I come out of the thermostat tradition. You turn up the heat with public pressure so that it changes the temperature where legislators and all have to deal with how we deal with these problems.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
That's the Reverend Al Sharpton. His new book is called Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. Coming up, a new exhibition traces the political education of Tupac Shakur. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
They claim that I'm violent just because I refuse to be silent. These hypocrites are having fits because I'm not buying it, defying it. Envious because I will rebel against any oppressor, and this is known as self-defense.
That is Violent by the late rapper Tupac Shakur. In 1996, Tupac was killed in a drive-by shooting in Las Vegas when he was only 25 years old, and that crime has never been solved. At the height of his popularity, his death at such a young age has made him even more revered, and not just for his music, for his political activism too. A new art installation at LA Live pays homage to Tupac, and it delves into some parts of his life that aren't as well known, like his early years with his mom, former Black Panther, Afeni Shakur. The exhibit is called Wake Me When I'm Free, and it runs until May. And here to talk about it is Justin Tinsley, senior culture writer for ESPN's The Undefeated and host of the 30 for 30 podcast, The King of Crenshaw. And that podcast followed the death of another rapper, Nipsey Hussle. Welcome to Press Play, Justin.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited to talk.
I know. I'm excited to hear what you have to say about Tupac, because I understand that he had a really big influence on you personally.
Oh, man. Whew. How much time do you have for that? Yes, Tupac Shakur is an artist. He's my personal favorite, you know, musician ever. And it's just because of an emotional connection I had to his music and just his life and just similar experiences that, you know, there's no one way to talk about this guy. Of course, you can focus on the music, which was powerful. It was emotional. It was tragic. And then, you know, you look at his movie career, and then you think about the controversy in his life. And like, I just became so enamored with who he was from a very young age that, you know, just learning about him in the, you know, quarter century since his passing, like it's been one of the most influential and necessary paths that I've taken that have led me to the career that I have right now. And Tupac Shakur plays a big role in that.
Wow, that's incredible. It's really, as you were outlining all his what he had done in his very short life, it's like he led two lives. It's incredible that he did so much before his death.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the early days then. Let's begin at the beginning. And he was influenced, this has been reported quite a bit, by his mom, who was a Black Panther, and she was very politically active. And so talk about how that is addressed in this exhibit and what it says about their relationship and how she molded him into the more politically active parts of his career.
When you look back on it and when you really look at his life and his mother's life, Tupac was born being watched. She was pregnant with him while she was fighting trial. The Panther 21 trial from the late 60s in New York. And in the exhibit, they have a stack of New York Times papers. And the reference for that is when Tupac would get in trouble, he wouldn't necessarily get beat, But his mother would go make him read the entire New York Times front to back and then come back with a report. So that type of worldview and that type of upbringing, that was with him from day one. And I think the museum does an incredible job showing that. Like, we hear so much about the controversies and the super high points and the super low points of Tupac's life, but we don't hear about how these experiences as a child made the who eventually became the young man.
Well, let's hear a song from his album Me Against the World, his 1995 yes. album Me Against the World. This one is called Dear Mama.
And who thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whooping to my backside. And even as a crack fiend, mama, you always was a black queen, mama. I finally understand for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Wow, such a complicated upbringing. She was, mm-hmm. as he mentions there, addicted to drugs for a while. And I guess that had an influence on him as well. So how did he resolve all those, or did he? Was he able to resolve or talk about all of these contradictions in his upbringing?
That's such a great question. And of course, you can't talk Tupac Shakur without talking to Phinny Shakur. They went through so much. You mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, she went from being in the revolution with the Panthers and then getting addicted to drugs for a little bit and him having to basically be drill sergeant to her. Like, you got to get your life together. You have to do this. But that bond was unbreakable. It was all he had. And when you listen to the song Dear Mama, which for me is my personal favorite rap song of all time, I don't think there's ever been a more beautiful, vulnerable and transparent ode to a parent in music history. And when you know the story that goes into that song, it's beautiful, but oh my God, is it tragic in so many ways. But yeah, at the end of absolutely. The day, it's very admirable too, because they went through hell and they never left each other, even in death.
It's also an homage to Black women in general and yeah. and how so many yeah. have had to raise their kids alone and struggle to do so and to try to keep them on the straight and narrow in a world that mm-hmm. is, you know, a difficult world and one that is very tempting.
You can't help but relate to that.
Yeah.
My mother still has a ringtone. You know, all these years later, she still has a ringtone. It's just one song. And it's this for whenever I call her, because she felt that behind those words. It's an emotional experience for her listening to that song, because while she may not know everything about Tupac, she felt the power and the passion behind that song.
So he writes really tenderly about his mom, and also about, there's another song where he writes about Black women in general and all the abuse that they have had to endure. And yet he was, you know, you talk about him going to prison. He was convicted of sexually abusing a woman in 1994
yep.
and he served nearly a year in prison. So what do you make of that contradiction?
That's always, and especially, you know, as I've gotten older and, you know, we're starting having like different conversations in the world, you know, you have to go back and revisit that case, because he understood that he put himself in a bad position right there. If you go back and read the 1995 Vibe interview, Jailhouse interview with Kevin Powell, he talks a lot about this. He put himself in a position that he should not have put himself in, but he maintains, you know, until his dying day, he speaks about it in his music. He was like, I am not guilty of the crime that I was committed of. And so I think about that, and I think about my own, just how I've evolved over time in terms of how I saw the world and what I thought. It's honestly really hard. And if you're trying to have an honest conversation on Tupac, you can't just cherry pick different parts of his life. You have to talk about it all. And mm-hmm. this is a case that redirected the course of his life. And it was a situation that he admittedly put himself in, And sometimes, you know, that is hard to reconcile. I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I'm willing to say I haven't totally figured out, but I know it's a conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah. And then he comes out of prison and with a new album, All Eyes on Me, as he's appealing his conviction. And that is a totally different album, right? The lyrics are different. Can you describe that transformation?
So he's sitting in jail for almost a year for a crime that he says he did not commit. And then he gets out of jail and then he signs with Death Row Records. And Death Row was the biggest label on the planet. And they were also the most feared. And so there was an element of mystery. There was an element of power. And honestly, there was an element of violence, too, that came with Death Row. So when you listen to that music, it's a lot more of a paranoid Tupac talking about all the injustices that he's faced in his life, and he's a lot more combative. I'm having nightmares, homicidal fantasies. I wake up strangling, dangling my bed sheets. I call a nurse cause it hurts to reminisce. How did it come to this? I wish they didn't miss. Somebody help me, tell me where to go from here. Cause even thugs cry, but do the Lord care? Trying to remember, but it hurts. So I'm walking through the cemetery, talking to the dirt. And so you hear that, and that's the Death Row sound, but that's also the sound of a man who probably had a million thoughts going through his head at once. You know, I look back on Tupac now, and I look at the conversation of mental health awareness. This was a conversation that we weren't having with Tupac, and we saw his life play out. So that last year of his life, while it was incredibly productive music-wise, there was a lot of anger there in Tupac.
But I think what's also really tragic about that is what we talk about when we talk about Tupac and the sort of the thug life tattoo and the East Coast, West Coast rivalry and the guns and the conviction, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And we don't talk about all of the really important political words that he was writing and the influence that he had in terms of rethinking about this systemic racism and incarceration and all of that and how young Black men are treated in this country. Really important messages that then have been, you know, not forgotten, but subsumed by the last part of his life, which was consumed with violence.
Yeah. I mean, you just mentioned it right there. And I know we spoke about it a little bit earlier. Like, there's so many entry points into his life. But the one thing he was born into was what he called the struggle. Like, he, regardless of wherever he was in his life, he never forgot what that feeling felt like. And from a very young age, he's reading Malcolm X. He's reading James Baldwin, Maya Angelou. He's becoming this type of person. And so those teachings and his own life experiences, they were, of course, going to permeate into his music because, in a way, that's all he knew. That's the first thing he knew, at least. And he saw the Black experience for what it was. And so that gave him a different perspective than a lot of his peers before and after. So when we talk about Tupac, we can't forget about those messages in his music because that's what he came in the world understanding his role and his responsibility was to be.
Well, let's go out on one last song. And of course, it's got to be California Love. Do you want to set this one up for us and talk about what he's talking about here?
Yeah, this is when we talk about anthems, this is up there with the greatest anthems of all time. This was the song that once Suge Knight and Death Row bailed Tupac out of prison, he flew straight to the studio. And California Love was originally supposed to be a Dr. Dre solo single. He was going to take that to Aftermath with him. But, you know, one thing led to another. Once Tupac got to the label in the fall of 1995, all focus on the label focused on Tupac. So everybody gave Tupac everything. And one of the songs was California Love. The word iconic gets thrown around a lot, but I think it's fitting right here. This is an iconic hip-hop record. And again, one of the best anthems you're ever going to hear.
Well, Justin, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for coming on today.
thank you so much for having me on. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Me too. Justin Tinsley, senior culture writer for ESPN's The Undefeated and host of the 30 for 30 podcast, The King of Crenshaw. And here it is, California Love. Out on bail, fresh out of jail, California dreaming. Soon as I step on the scene, I'm hearing Hoochie screaming, fiending for money and alcohol. And that's it for us here on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.